Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of On the Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. I am your host, Antonio Val. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show. Dear all, and welcome to one more episode of LSE's On the Case. Today, we are honored to host one of the top and most powerful legal figures in Europe and the world, President Lennart. Our guest studied at the Catholic University of Leuven and Harvard University, and has, since 2015, been the president of the Court of Justice of the European Union. Thank you so much for coming today. And without further ado, I'd like to ask you, what made you choose to pursue a career in the law?
Well, in part, this is, of course, the outcome of accident, so to speak. I had a big interest as a young person in politics and public life, so to speak. And of course, from one you come into the other. I mean, you start getting intrigued by living peacefully and respectfully together in a society and all that it requires for that to be so, which is not that obvious, as we can unfortunately see these times and in many places in the world. So I'm a child of the late 60s and the 70s in terms of my political awareness, so to speak, starting as a teenager in the late 60s, so to speak, and then throughout the 70s. And I discovered more or less along the way, when I was still in secondary school, in high school, that law is actually the basis for living peacefully and respectfully together in a society between human beings who all have their own identity and their own views in life and views on life. And how can this then be done? And that was, in fact, I know it sounds a little bit abstract, but I spoke with people who were active in politics, with people who are also in my family, a wider family, at a bar. And from one to the other, I came to studying law as the natural outcome of my interest in public life more generally and in the living together in a society.
Of course. Thank you. And it can be said that throughout these years dedicated to the law, most of them were dedicated to European law, firstly as a professor, and then in the Court of Justice, beginning as a legal secretary, then a judge, and now president. Truly believe in the European project. Where do you think this passion comes from?
Well, it's absolutely so that I strongly believe in the European project, and it's in fact ensuing straight on what I just said. If you see the history of the European continent, it displays sequences of rivalry and also of armed conflict. So the challenge for law to make a rules-based project which makes states and peoples, and I say peoples plural, each one with their own languages, religions, societal views, historical backgrounds, etc., peacefully live together, and to organize that in a common legal order and governed by a common governance structure, that was intriguing me. And so as a law student, I was studying first in Namur, and that matters because that is in the Walloon part of Belgium. I'm a Flemish, a Dutch speaker, but I started my study, which was a big challenge, in the other national language, which I didn't know that well at age 17, but I really wanted to discover the other persons in our country. Now French has become a second mother tongue almost for me, but it was not the case at age 17. So there I already was intrigued by the fact that people have different identities, yet that they share their core essence of human beings entitled to respect for human dignity and for their identity as far as language, culture, religion, any other opinions goes. We're all equals. And so I studied first in Wallonia, then in Flanders, in Leuven. And then I went on studying the constitutional law system of the United States of America at Harvard. And that was a very deliberate choice. I specialized, as I already told, in public law, constitutional law, administrative law, the public law segments, international law, and also European community law, as it was called at the time. So it all made sort of one big ensemble of interests. And the logical component of that study course was then to go to the United States and to discover their system. And that was really an eye-opener for me, how this federalism in the United States was formatted with a very subtle balance between federal law and state law. And I started using the categories and the concepts of American constitutional law to more deeply understand the European integration process. But please do not misunderstand me, and I say this with absolute insistence. It was never, and also today is never my intention, to sort of try to make the European Union into a sort of United States type of governance structure in Europe. No, it's not that. It's simply that in the United States over the past 230 years, they have developed experience with multi-level governance, with division of competence between states and the federal system, with the primacy of federal law over state law, with state courts and federal courts interacting with one another. So in many respects, all the tools we use to achieve the European Union as a common governance structure and a common legal order had been tested over the past two centuries in the United States. And so when I came back, I said, that's the field in which I want to make my doctoral dissertation. And in a way, the whole development of the European Union, I would not have dreamt it when at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, I was analogizing some aspects of European community law, as it was at the time, with US constitutional law. The skeptics vis-a-vis my research said, but you are sort of daydreaming. You are thinking that you are comparing two things which are comparable, but that is totally different. But then, you know, the Single European Act came in 1987, the direct election of the European Parliament with legislative powers, which were always increased, now leading to a strictly bicameral system between the European Parliament and the Council of the European Union, which is not all that different from the House of Representatives and the Senate in the United States. And you see, so gradually, many of the blanks in my comparative law scheme of developed in the first years of the 1980s gradually came through in actual reality. So in a way, the four decades which came after my doctoral work, and that's about where we are, I defended the dissertation in 1982, we're now 24 almost, so it's 42 years ago. So, I mean, that explains also my career path, that I wanted to cooperate and to actively contribute in the coming about of such a consolidated common governance structure, common legal order. But you hear me say it repeatedly. The European Union is not a state. It's not meant to be a state. It's not meant to become a state or a federal state. So in that sense, there is no comparison with the United States. It is something of its own, but it's using legal concepts and reasonings which have been in an instrumental way developed in the United States before.
And my personal opinion, that's what makes the European Union beautiful, the ability to borrow some concepts.
That's also my opinion. That's why I'm stressing. You know, there is a decision of the court that those who are listening to your podcast, they should know it. The famous opinion 2/13 on the possible accession of the European Union to the European Convention on Human Rights. There the court says expressly that the European Union is not a state. Mm-hmm. And what is it positively? It is a common legal order. And that we set in the conditionality judgments, full court judgments of the 16th of February 2022, where we said that the common governance structure, the common legal order, is based on the values of Article 2. And those values, when you add them all up, they are in the number of 12, like the 12 stars on the European flag. It's human dignity, freedom, democracy, respect for the rule of law, human rights. And then it goes on in a society characterized by pluralism, tolerance, equality, including protection of rights of minorities, and solidarity. All these values, it's fleshed out a bit further, all these values must be shared by all the member states in order to be able to be part of the club, because you don't want to be seen in a single governance structure, in a single legal order, dealing with plenty of policy matters when you're not sharing basically the same concepts. So these are fundamental concepts determining the living together in a complex multi-identity society.
I can't help to notice that most of the critical moments you were mentioning were in fact moments of change. And we can say that right now the European Union is also going through a critical period of change and of transition, especially in relationship to the rule of law. And in 2021, you expressed your concerns as to the state of the rule of law in the European Union and its potential impact upon the survival of the organization. You also wrote an article entitled New Horizons for the Rule of Law within the European Union, where you emphasized that the Court of Justice, in cases like Commission against Poland, is starting to engage more directly with core values linked to a healthy rule of law, such as judicial independence. However, up to now, this engagement has still been a bit reluctant and never too express or direct. At a time where the Union is potentially expanding, where there has been an increasing polarization of the political realm with the growth of aggressive parties, and where individual freedoms and equality seem to be constantly harassed by countries like Hungary, for example, is it time that the Court of Justice takes a further step and asserts its power, perhaps through a direct engagement with what you were talking about, Article 2?
The answer is that the Court of Justice, as a matter of fact, has already done that. And it has done that in a rather remarkable way, in the sense that the first institution which enforced Article 2, when it comes to respect for the rule of law and the enforcement of judicial independence within the member state judicial structures, the first steps have come from the Court of Justice, but like always, the Court of Justice is a court. It cannot seize itself of a problem. It has to wait for a case being brought. And I'm so happy because you are of Portuguese origin, as you said. It is in honor of the Supremo Tribunal Administrativo in Lisbon, the Supreme Administrative Court of Portugal. It is their merit. And they deserve the credit for having been the first to submit to the Court of Justice a case on independence of national judges. Now, rest assured, there was no problem of independence in that very case. And there was no problem with the Portuguese law whatsoever. Let that be very clear. But why I give all the credit for having allowed the Court of Justice to develop the rule of law case law to this Portuguese Supreme Administrative Court? Well, because they made a reference for a preliminary ruling. It's the famous judgment of the Grand Chamber of our court of the 27th of February 2018, Associação Sindical dos Juízes Portugueses.
Yeah, that's perfect Portuguese.
I trained it with my Portuguese colleague, and so that's what Europe is. It's united in diversity, right? And you probably know what the case is about. It were a number of judges of the Tribunal de Contas who said that their independence was being violated, infringed, through a reduction in their salary. Mm-hmm. Now, this was being contested, so they contested before the Supreme Administrative Court the reduction decision of their salaries. And they said this is against the independence, and now it comes as protected in the Portuguese constitution, but also as protected in Article 2, mm-hmm. in combination with Article 19 of the Treaty on European Union, that is the article stating that every member state should guarantee effective judicial protection in the fields covered by union law, and Article 47 of the Charter of Fundamental Rights, the right to effective judicial protection of the rights and obligations flowing from union law. Now, the reason why the case is important is not what the court said on the merits of judicial independence, because as you're well aware of, the Portuguese judges lost their case. The court said, totally in line with what the Supreme Administrative Court and the Constitutional Court of Portugal said, if there is a horizontal reduction in the salaries in the framework there, you know, of the Eurozone austerity programs of 12, 13 years ago, and this touches everyone, the prime minister, the legislator, the highest administrative officials, the ambassadors, it can also touch the judges. So there was no targeting of the judges. There was no problem of judicial independence. However, the important part of that judgment is that our court accepted jurisdiction to make a pronouncement on the independence of national courts. And the reason why we accepted that jurisdiction, as you know, is that national courts are the courts of general jurisdiction, general application and enforcement of union law rights and obligations. So we said if a national court were to be not independent, not impartial, then the enforcement of union law rights and obligations would be endangered. And this is not a theoretical pronouncement. Take principles like the primacy of union law. The primacy of union law leads to the obligation to set aside the application of conflicting national rules and to apply the union law rules having direct effect, right? But the national judge needs to be independent. If the national judge is put under pressure by the political majority of the day in his or her country to always rule in favor of national law, whatever the conflict be with union law, you see, there is nothing left of what we all have studied as the cornerstones of the common legal order, Van Gent en Loos, direct effect, 1963, etc., etc. All these principles become empty promises if the judges are under the political pressure to always rule for the national rules, etc., etc. So that is reason why we accepted that jurisdiction. It is only after the court had delivered that Portuguese judge's judgment, as it is still called, that the commission took over the initiative. But the first initiative was the Tribunal Supremo Administrativo. Yeah. The second initiative is the commission. It started launching infringement actions against the member states. And with respect, I wouldn't say that the Court of Justice has not been courageous. Because if you look at our case law, you know the infringement judgments against Poland, for instance, this was never seen before. And this is all since that Portuguese judge's judgment that is less than 6 years ago. So we have now tens and tens and tens of cases involving rule of law deficiencies, systemic deficiencies in a number of member states. And you know, these cases, even when these judgments are not immediately implemented, of course it is then for the commission to oversee the compliance with the judgments. But sometimes, as you know, and I will not have to be more specific, elections bring another government to power. And that other government then says, well, hey, we have in fact all these beautiful judgments of the Court of Justice. They're all benchmarks to be respected in order to reform the system, again, in compliance with rule of law standards. So that is how the Court of Justice deals with it. But in all these judgments, Article 2 is center stage. It's Article 2 further developed in the Charter of Fundamental Rights, or Article 2 further developed in Article 19, or in some of the Hungarian cases about the Central European University. It was in combination with the freedom of establishment, etc., etc. So all of that is on public record. Eh? But so in these past 6 years, let's say, there has been a massive commitment by the Court of Justice of the European Union to upholding the values of Article 2. But of course, we only do it when a case is brought to us in an admissible way, that is, by a party entitled to do so, and respecting all the admissibility requirements, which is normally the case.
And it seems clear that over the past years, there has been a tendency to move towards a more legalized approach towards breaches of EU law. And recently, as we saw, the parliament showed its support to the proceedings being brought against Hungary. However, we see countries like Poland who would rather pay sanctions than to accept the demands of the Commission and the courts. Do you think that the Union is in need of reinventing its enforcement mechanisms and reshaping itself to guarantee more compliance by the member states?
Well, I think the Union has, over the years, strengthened its enforcement mechanisms enormously. If you know that, for instance, before the Lisbon Treaty, the non-transposition of a directive could not lead to financial sanctions until there was a second finding of breach, of infringement. The Lisbon Treaty made it possible to impose financial sanctions from the first time onwards. Because, of course, 80% of union legislation comes in the form of directives. And as you know, directives will only be effective in the field when they have been integrated into national law. So it's a crucial element. So this is a major step in enforcement. And so we are regularly subjecting member states to financial sanctions because they were late in terms of the respecting the transposition time limit in the directive. So I think that is important also to stress. In addition, the court has, in interim relief orders, also imposed these periodic penalty payments in order to comply with the interim relief orders. Now you say some member states will more easily pay than comply. But of course, in the end, we must be honest with one another. Also in the national context, when a public party is being convicted and the party is not complying with the order or is paying even the periodic penalty payment, that's a difficult matter to handle. And of course, it's perverting the judicial process. A court is created in order to have its judgments decide the case and have all those bound by that judgment comply with it loyally. The loyalty, the union loyalty, Article 4, paragraph 3, implies that member states also behave as members of the club. You're not like random states around the globe. On the European continent, if you make the constitutional moment of accession, constitutional moment is the concept of Bruce Ackerman, professor in Yale Law School, it's really a constitutional moment. It means that you, as a state, accept to attune your constitutional characteristics on the mold of the European Union, and to do everything needed to comply with that. And certainly when it comes to compliance with the values of Article 2.
Of course.
And here, the rule of law value. So the treaty positively starts from the premise that accession and membership mean that you're loyal to the Union, but even more importantly, to the 26 other member states. And that's, of course, also the basis of the principle of mutual trust, mutual recognition. I gave a totally hypothetical example. Suppose you know the system of driving licenses. You're a young person, you have a driving license, and you got it in one member state. I will not name any. Automatically, your driving license is recognized in all the other member states. Suppose in a member state, it were so that, you know, they can in fact, with a little bribe, be bought these driving licenses.
Of course.
You will immediately say, yes, of course. If that were discovered, you would have to discontinue recognizing the driving licenses delivered by that member state. Because you would say this leaves the framework of the paradigm in which you trust one another, that you all have serious rules. You would say, hey, we can't recognize these driving licenses. And the member state concerned might be a little bit offended and saying, yes, yes, but I mean, there might have been some cases of fraud, but that is not generalized, and it's maybe an accident de parcours or whatever. If you don't recognize my driver's license, I will not recognize yours any longer. This totally hypothetical example shows that if member states are no longer complying with the basic understanding of judicial independence, loyal enforcement of the primacy and direct effect of union law rules, which means rules common to all 27 member states, respect for the charter rights, charter of fundamental rights, then of course the context of recognizing and enforcing judicial decisions of another member state, think about the Brussels regulations in recognition and enforcement of judgments in civil and commercial matters, in criminal matters, the European arrest warrant. If you're no longer trusting that a criminal court, which issues a European arrest warrant, is doing this in full independence, impartiality, just applying the law after a fair proceeding, then you might be tempted no longer to accept to implement such arrest warrants, judicial decisions. And that is why what we're discussing here is not just theory. It is really, really important for the Union as we know it to consolidate as a single space without controls at the internal borders between member states, full free movement, but also accompanied by police cooperation, judicial cooperation in all the relevant fields, common asylum and immigration policies, enforced properly and in compliance with fundamental rights. In all these very sensitive policies, the member states must trust one another. And that trust will only be there, like for the driver's licenses, when the system inside each one of the member states functions properly, that is in compliance with the basic understanding of what a judicial process is.
But we saw, for example, in 2008, after the financial crisis, that there was an understanding that there had to be more control by the Union to ensure this same compliance in relation to the banks. And right now, we could say that we're going through a rule of law crisis. Do you think that there could be any analogy in terms of like imposing greater control over national courts as well, or that would be going too far?
Yeah, it's not a matter of too far or not far enough. I think the most important remark I must make there is that the two things are not totally comparable. In the financial crisis, it is a more limited, it's very important, but it is a more limited technical field. And I say this against the background, and you will be amazed when I'm saying this, that in the United States of America, I told you about my comparative law interest with the U.S., do you know that the banking market is less liberalized at nationwide level in the United States of America than in Europe? And yet, no one will deny that the United States is a far more deeply integrated federal system, a single nation state at the federal level, and so on and so forth. So I mean by that, for important that the free movement of financial services is, and that the banking union is, the union could survive without a fully fledged banking union as we are now aiming for. However, for the rule of law crisis, the union cannot survive with member states who defraud on the independence of justice, because then they would in fact cheat as far as the general compliance and enforcement of union law rules in whatever field, when the member states are not complying with their duties across the board, which might be the outcome of a rule of law crisis, then you speak about an existential characteristic of the union as a common legal order, which would no longer be there. So the sort of existential premise would no longer be filled in. And that is of a different nature, you see. And that also explains why the reaction of the union to the rule of law crisis is such a strong one. And that is also the reason why the union legislator stepped in, because the courts can't do everything. We live in a representative democracy. The union legislature, that means the directly elected European Parliament, along with the Council of the European Union, they really must step in and specify what it takes to comply with these common values and to make that into a condition for receiving funds under the solidarity mechanisms operating inside the union. And you know that the Council and the Parliament did that in the famous regulation on conditionality, a horizontal conditionality mechanism, a mechanism which the court upheld in terms of legality control after actions for annulment were brought by Poland and Hungary against the European Parliament and the Council to have that conditionality regulation quashed. So there you see that all the institutions, the Commission making the proposal, the European Parliament supporting it in amended form, the Council supporting it in amended form, the Court of Justice upholding the legality. And so now the mechanism is starting to deploy its effects. So that is really existential. So yes, each crisis is a little bit different, but it's absolutely existential for the Union that this challenge be successfully met.
Thank you. I just have three questions that I really want to ask you. So I'm going to try to make sure I'm fast. First of all, I'd like to speak a bit about the reform to the preliminary reference procedure that is currently being discussed. This would encompass the delegation of jurisdiction over certain matters to the General Court. I would like to ask, at a time where many claim that there is a lack of input legitimacy in the EU as a whole, wouldn't it be more appropriate to empower and place greater reliance on national courts instead? Obviously, we have just spoken about the rule of law and how some national courts cannot be trusted. But I'm speaking just from a long-term perspective. Wouldn't it make more sense to place greater reliance on national courts?
Thank you for this excellent question, albeit that it rests, I think, on a radical misunderstanding of how the present system works. I said that it is the national courts and no one else being the proximity courts to the citizen and being the courts of general jurisdiction for the application and enforcement of union law. But your question now allows me to be more concrete. So contrary to what the question suggests, the sharing of the burden of some preliminary rulings with the general court is not an attempt to draw more work to Luxembourg. On the contrary, the work comes through the national courts and through no one else to Luxembourg. So I, as a Belgian citizen, you as a Portuguese citizen, you can have a problem with your own member state administration or with another member state's administration, doesn't matter, and you go to the local courts to bring that dispute to them. Let's say, to take a concrete example, it's always more telling than the abstract formulations. Suppose you are a business person and there is a tax administration which sends you a VAT invoice, and you say that VAT invoice is wrong, I have to pay far too much, and they badly applied the directive 2006/112, which is the VAT code at union level in the form of a directive that is, of course, transposed in the 27 member states. And so you say the tax administration wrongly applied, let's now say, the Portuguese law transposing the directive, because the Portuguese law needs to be interpreted in line with the directive, and the proper understanding of the directive is so and so in my favor. So I should pay less. Where do you bring your case? In the Portuguese court competent for such tax matters. It's actually a tribunal arbitral, fiscal. And that's fair enough. And it's a different type of court in Belgium. And in Germany, it would be a Finanzgericht. In France, a tribunal administratif. It's very different because every member state has its own judicial organization. And that's absolutely fine because that's an expression of their local choices and identity. It's perfect. So what you're saying is, union law, because you rely on a rule of union law, in order to claim back the taxes you think you have paid too much, all in the national courts. And then it is a matter of the national court, that is the national judges, to say, well, this is not clear how we should proceed in such a case. So they are then asking questions to the Court of Justice. That's the preliminary reference procedure. But the very existence of the preliminary reference procedure is testimony to the fact that the proximity court is the national court. Now, these courts, like the Supremo Tribunal Administrativo in the Portuguese judges case, they carve out the questions of union law, which they certify to the Court of Justice, they refer, and the court, after a pan-European debate, because all the member states are authorized to intervene in such a debate, the court comes to a common understanding of the rule that is sent back to the national court, but has also precedent value in all 27 member states. And that is how union law is kept common. Mm-hmm. What does the reform do? The reform has now singled out six technical matters, like Article 256, third paragraph of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union allows for it, that is, that in these technical matters, it be the general court answering the reference for a preliminary ruling as a specialized court. And these matters are value-added tax, excise taxes, the customs code, the nomenclature of customs tariffs, passengers' rights for cancelled and delayed flights, and lastly, the emission trading system for carbon dioxide emissions. And so, all in all, we get 500 references for a preliminary ruling per year. That will amount to about 70 to 90 cases a year. But they are technical. They are severable from the remainder with horizontal relevance of union law matters, because if there is an horizontal big principle or primary law or a charter of fundamental rights, it stays before the Court of Justice. So it is really to make the general court a specialized court, in particular in these indirect taxation cases. But again, this is only to make a better division of work inside the Court of Justice of the European Union, which is the name, as you know, of the institution as a whole, and inside that institution between the Court of Justice proper, that is the upper court, and then the first instance court, general court, but which now becomes Second, to being an administrative first instance court, it also becomes a specialized court for these matters. But if need be, there is a possibility of an exceptional review by the Court of Justice of these judgments of the General Court on the initiative of the First Advocate General. That is really after the model of the Cassation dans l'intérêt de la loi. It's the French system of upholding the uniformity of jurisprudence in the interest of the law. So it's a bit complex, but that it's very clear this is not an attempt to draw more to Luxembourg and take it away or to change anything in that relationship. It will stay what it has always been, but the Court of Justice can really develop like a constitutional stroke Supreme Court.
Thank you. Now, just bringing in another completely different issue. We obviously know that the EU is an important actor in international law too, and over the past years, we have seen a deterioration of our global institutions and the rule of law throughout the world. We have witnessed serious violations of human rights by an increasing number of autocratic states, a greater tendency by countries to resort to war rather than diplomacy. But even in countries like the UK, where I study, some threats by the government to repeal the Human Rights Act, which represents the values upon which Western democracies were built. Do you think, Mr. President, that we are at the end of a cycle of rules-based order?
Well, your question is, of course, to be put in the first place to the political leaders of the UK, of the EU, and of the member states of the EU. Let that be clear. The only thing I can say that is that as a court of justice, we are more determined than ever to uphold the values which keep these 27 member states of the Union peacefully and securely together. And that is already quite a challenge because there is a big diversity also inside the Union, but also when it comes to dealings of the European Union with third states, such as Turkey, for instance, we have, or with the UK, that's now a third state. So there the court must always see that these dealings are complying with the values of the external action of the European Union. It's Article 21 of the Treaty on European Union, values which themselves square with the values of Article 2, and also the fact that Article 3, paragraph 5 of the Treaty on European Union says that the Union promotes in the international context the values on which it is itself founded. So it's really a political task. Sometimes it reaches the court when there is, for instance, disagreement as to how to interpret such things or legality control also. But there are many pending cases, so I cannot really be too far in that. But you know about the Western Sahara issue, for instance, that's now pending in the Grand Chamber. But it shows that the system works insofar as what you raise here as an issue, it reaches the court, whether it be one of the actors involved, like the European Commission or a member state, bringing a case to court when they're entitled to do so, or it are national judges who ask through references for preliminary rulings how they should understand the law.
Thank you. And yeah, you mentioned Northern Ireland, the Northern Ireland Protocol, and that's the last question I want to ask you. So obviously the recent negotiations between the UK and the EU are very positive because the UK is showing some signs of proximity to the EU. But we have seen over the past years many threats by UK governments to breach treaties with the EU. And so I'd like to ask you two small questions. What remedies do we have if the UK chooses to breach any of the terms of its agreement, the Northern Ireland Protocol it has just signed with the EU? And secondly, do you think that this attitude shown sometimes by the UK and its government of supremacy and sovereignty was the reason why the UK left in the first place?
Well, first of all, what are the remedies? For that, you need to read the withdrawal agreement and the trade and cooperation agreement. That agreement contains provisions in relation to remedies. But of course, on top of that, This is a treaty between the European Union and the United Kingdom. Like any treaty, it's the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, codifying customary public international law. They must be implemented in good faith, pacta sunt servanda, and member states cannot avail themselves of their constitutional structures in order to escape their obligation to comply with commitments entered into, unless the unconstitutionality of the commitments was utterly clear also to the third party. All of this is a paraphrasing of what you read in that Vienna Convention of 1969. And of course, it all boils down to aspects of good faith. Huh? That's basically also what it is. The second part of what you mentioned on Brexit, it is difficult to say. It is clear that it's more to see with emotion than with rationality, so to speak. But my view on this, and now with sort of the advantage of being a few years past all of this Brexit thing, you know, the United Kingdom was, of course, a member of the European Union. But in fact, it wanted itself to be stuck in the stage of the Union in which it entered in 1973. Not only do people speak about the common market, and like an Heathrow flights to Europe, Europe being the continent, so there has never been in the minds and in the hearts of the people a sense of belonging to a common identity, which is Europe. And that's not bad. I mean, this is simply the outcome of history. Be that as it may, I have no problems with that. But that is a general background. And you can see that at each treaty change, in all these important steps, the UK had a total dropout, derogation, or cherry-picking, pick and choose what was interesting and not the rest. So, for observers of European Union law, and also in my comparative academic exercise with the United States, it was written in the stars that you can't stay in if you really want to be out. And it's quite all right. I have no criticism on that. I say that without the slightest emotion. But you see, the UK has never been in the single currency. The UK has nothing to see with the Schengen area. Yes, but if you ask here in Portugal or in Belgium, whether it be Flanders or Wallonia, what are for young people the main achievements? They will say, we can travel everywhere, we can study everywhere, the open borders, it's a free movement, the common currency, we pay everywhere with the same currency. So the visible signs of the belonging, of the developing the sense of belonging to a common destiny, they never had that. And that is, of course, for my standards, the true reason. They have not learned either to sort of work together in a common governance structure where you cannot always have the last word. And that's, of course, this whole historical thing of empire and commonwealth. But the best way to conclude is to refer to an absolutely certain source, and that is Winston Churchill, who in a speech in September 1946 spoke about the need to develop something, and those are his words, like a United States of Europe. That is Churchill. But the important part now comes. He said, of course, the United Kingdom should never be part of that. Because together with the United States of America, you see the Atlantism, we already form the most successful organization of the Western Hemisphere. That's how it's to stay there. And he referred to the British Empire, then you have a stroke, Commonwealth of Nations. And so, in fact, people always say, yes, De Gaulle in the 1960s had a veto against the entrance. No, De Gaulle echoed Churchill. De Gaulle said, they are not of the kind we can construe a European community with, because they're in another mindset. So De Gaulle and Churchill were basically in agreement with one another. And then they came in because, you know, the United Kingdom are trade people. You study in the United Kingdom, you know this. So they made a calculation, we're better in than out. Yeah. The balance sheet will be better. But if that is the basis, if after 47 years you say the balance sheet is no longer what we thought it would look like, then you step out because you're only there for the balance sheet anyway. And so I think that is the core essence of the Brexit. But I think now the relation is much better because all that really mattered is now regulated in bilateral agreements. And it's better to have an outside position with a bilateral agreement, but with an outsider. So it does not pollute, in a way, the internal process of the union by someone who is not there in the same mindset and with the same sense of belonging than the others.
Just as a last thing, I would like you to, if possible, give some advice to our LSE community, to an aspiring lawyer.
Well, I would maybe give the advice, listen deeply to what others have to say. And don't think, I say that also to myself, that you're necessarily always right. Because other people also think. And making the synthesis of all of this is the true work of a lawyer. I end with what I began with. That is to say, law is about living together in a community. It's not about affirming one's rights at all price. It is making the synthesis between rights and obligations in a spirit of loyalty to make it happen together. That's the role of the lawyer.
Thank you so much, President Lennertz. It was a brilliant interview.
Thank you. Thank you, Antonio.